Welcome to Conversations with the Masters with your host, Master Certified Coach Mary Allen. This special interview series is designed to enlighten and empower you by bringing you the best-selling authors, speakers, and organizations of our time. So get ready to listen not only with your ears and mind, but with your entire being. And now, here's your host, Mary Allen.
Welcome all of our listeners today to this Conversations with the Masters call with, of course, Adya Shanti. And most of you know me, but some of you don't. My name is Mary Allen, and I'm a Master Certified Life Coach. I am an author of The Power of Inner Choice, and I am your host of the Conversations with the Masters series. But I want to thank everyone for being with us today, and I really want to thank those of you who graciously spread the word about this call. And I want to specifically acknowledge thinkholistic.com and planetteleclass.com, and welcome all of the listeners who happen to be here as a result of these online newsletters. And while all of the conversations with the Masters are just so dear to me, I'm just particularly awed by the overwhelming response we had to today's call. The subjects of enlightenment and awakening aren't necessarily everyday conversations in a lot of circles, but I have this sense that many of you who are listening are well on your path, and perhaps today's call can nudge you along on your journey, or maybe even help you understand something you've already experienced. And I know there's also those of you who are just intrigued with this idea of enlightenment, and you're in the perfect company also. And I do want to just invite everyone to listen today with more than just your ears. Really allow your body to absorb the energy and wisdom that Adya will be sharing. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Adya Shanti or got referred at the last minute, he began teaching in 1996 at the request of his Zen teacher, whom he'd been studying with for 14 years. He's experienced his own series of transformative spiritual awakenings, and many spiritual seekers have awakened to their true nature while spending time with Adya. Adya's teachings have been compared to some of the early Zen masters of China, as well as masters of Advaita Vedanta. I don't think I said that right, which is an
close idiot. Enough.
Is that close enough?
Very close.
Oh, good.
Very close.
And I know, Adya, you don't necessarily like people to brag on you and so forth, but you are the author of several great books, one of which is True Meditation, which I have to say I read yesterday in one sitting and just melted into and just, oh, it was so wonderful.
Oh, good. Glad it had that effect on you.
It really did. My husband was commenting in the night. He's like, yep, you're in that zone right now. And I also just want to comment that I love your Spontaneous Awakening CD series. And if anyone does live in the Bay Area or even wants to come to fly to the area, there's weekend intensive, there's silent retreats. And I'm really excited that my husband and I are going to be attending one of those week-long silent retreats the first week of May. So.
Oh, lovely.
So, and, well, so Adya, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Yeah. Very, very well. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, I have to warn you, I have a lot of questions, and
well, good.
We'll do our best to get to as many as possible.
Okay. Good.
I thought we could start with a nice, simple question, such as, you know, what is enlightenment?
Oh, a nice, simple question,
nice, simple
huh?
Nice, question. How about we just get started there?
That's easy.
We can sum that one up in, what, 30 seconds?
Well, I'd love to be able to do that. I'll do the best I can. let's just say this. I think it's easy. I always like to demystify things as much as I can because I think it's the mystification of things that often gets in the way. Enlightenment is nothing more or nothing less than the perception of reality. That's what enlightenment is. To perceive what is instead of to perceive what isn't. How's that?
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I know
that makes it sound so simple that, okay, if we can just receive reality for what it is,
right.
That's it.
That's it. That's what enlightenment is. That's what it's all about, is just the perception of reality. From that point, when spiritual teachers then try to describe what that reality is, that's where, even though we all make our best efforts, that's when things get somewhat misleading, because it's like everything else, the description of something and the actual experiencing of it is very different. In the same way that, I could describe going to New York City to someone who's never gone, and they can listen to it, and they can even understand it, and they can get a real feel for it. But when they actually go to New York City and stand on the street corner, it's going to be completely different than everything they've ever heard about it. So that's one of the things about with enlightenment too. And enlightenment is simply the perception, the experience of reality as it actually is, when the mind and the emotional body isn't distorting it.
So what's the experience of, how most people then are experiencing reality?
Well, most people are experiencing reality, of course, through their mind, which means most people's reality, what's real to most people is the contents of their minds, right? What they believe, what they think, what they imagine, people's image of themselves, which is sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes indifferent, often competing. The stories we tell ourselves about other people, about the world, this sort of constant inner dialogue, which of course gives rise to inner feelings about the dialogue. And so most human beings are actually living in that dialogue. They're living in an alternative reality, right? Or I guess in the computer age we call it a virtual reality,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep. So is that really true? There's so much talk that we are living in the spiritual talk, is that it really is just a virtual reality, and that it's our minds that is creating reality. I mean, what is your perception of that? I mean, are we really just creating our own reality?
Well, Not in the way that if I just said, yeah, we're creating our own reality, that would be misleading, because part and parcel of really waking up to reality, what enlightenment is the realization that there really isn't a bunch of separate beings, separate things called yous and me's that go around creating reality. It's the little me doesn't actually create reality. The little me is actually a virtual reality that exists only in the mind. And so from that standpoint, from the standpoint of the me, it can't be creating reality, because it itself doesn't actually have any existence outside of the thoughts and conclusions and beliefs that go into making it up. What I'm talking about, I could talk about this on a more ultimate level, but I find that confuses people. On a simpler level, when I'm talking about what most people view as reality, I'm talking about the psychological, what most people think is their reality is a psychological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, to bring it down to something that's very simple, somebody says something to you that you don't like or you don't agree with, and your mind says, that person shouldn't have said that. And so then you create a psychological reality. Your reality becomes, that person shouldn't have said that. And then your body, of course, your body will duplicate your thoughts, so you'll start feeling as if somebody shouldn't have said that. You'll feel the anger or the resentment or whatever, and so you'll have thoughts and feelings, and that will be your reality. You will live the reality which is based on a thought that says, so-and-so shouldn't have said that to me.
And when we get caught up in those thoughts, then we're really actually missing the real reality, which is ticking along just fine.
It's ticking along just fine. I mean, in one sense, this is kind of a relative sense, but in a relative sense, reality is simply what's happening. So somebody did say something to you, and that's all. They said something that you liked or you didn't like, but But it's the secondary interpretation where most people live their lives, and they're interpreting what happens to them. And then that interpretation is taken to be real. Does it make sense?
It actually makes perfect sense to me.
and then sadly, then we go along and our whole lives become living in this constant state of inner interpretation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Which tends to be a lot more miserable than if we just were aligned with reality as it was rolling along.
Exactly. The awakening, certainly the enlightenment part of it, we call it awakening because it feels like that, not because something actually awakens, because reality is already awake. But it feels like, from the standpoint of the person, it feels like one has woken up out of a dream, and the dream we wake up out of is basically this dream of all these living in one's personal psychology and thinking that you are the person that psychology, you know, pertains to. And the awakening is realizing that, number one, that person isn't who you are. That person that you thought you were doesn't actually exist in any way outside of thinking. And the whole world that imaginary person created was virtual. It wasn't actually true. It has nothing to do with reality. And one can understand this intellectually beforehand, but it's something of a different order of magnitude when the experience, or when the actual happening, when you actually find yourself completely outside of it, so that none of your identity is being derived from one's, what could say, personal psychology.
So in speaking to identity, because there's a lot of in your teachings about how we really want to let go of being so identified with ourselves and our roles and so forth. Isn't it useful to have some kind of identity? Or is that really what's getting in the way?
Well, see, I mean, the question's great, but let me sort of reorient the question, because as far as I'm concerned as a spiritual teacher, the question isn't whether it's useful to have an identity. The question is any identity actually real? You see the difference?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're going to be stuck in ego land, right, in the land where you really believe in your identity, I often say to people, look, if you're going to stay stuck in the dream state, it's better that you can dream better.
Right.
You might as well have a better, more highly functional dream. So to have a better identity is more enjoyable than to have a bad identity.
Right.
But enlightenment really isn't about making the dream state better. That may happen as a byproduct. But ultimately, truth isn't really about improving. It's not the motivation to improve anything. Is this whole identity thing, does it have substance? Is there actually an identity that's true? Or is identity itself a fabrication, a psychological phenomenon, and nothing more?
So what is the truth about identity? I mean,
that's the whole point, isn't it? That's the crux of everything, which is why I often return to it in many of the ways that I teach, is because I see that it's the identity that is the crux of everything, because, of course, everybody's life revolves around themselves, right? Even the quest for enlightenment, people, you know, the way that we engage in it from the identity is, I want to be enlightened, right? The identity is actually seeking enlightenment. The irony is that when the enlightenment comes, it is seeing that identity itself is a fabrication, that what we are has nothing to do with an identity. And we only think of it, it's really hard for people to even think of it in these terms, because we're literally taught, our minds are conditioned to think about ourselves in terms of an identity. And for most people, it's almost impossible for them to think in terms of what they are, being completely divorced from any notion of identity. See, it's almost like thought can't do that. So the core of the teaching really is to examine all of anything that we think we are, any piece of our identity, whether it's a negative, very harmful, shameful, guilt-ridden identity, or if it's a very, nicely intact, well-functional, relatively happy identity. The core of spirituality that's really aimed at real awakening, enlightenment, is really looking right at that identity, because it's that identity that thinks it's the center of the universe, and that's what creates the sense of separateness. And when that identity is at once seen completely through, it is then seen that everything that we ever thought we were wasn't what we were, couldn't be what we were. And all that's left then is reality, because it's the truth of the matter is it's not you or I as a person or an identity that wakes up. That's not what wakes up. What wakes up is reality. Reality becomes conscious through this person, you could say. It's not the person that wakes up any more than when you have a dream at night and you wake up from the dream. It's not the character you were playing in the dream doesn't wake up. You wake up from the character you were playing in your dream.
Like reality is waking up inside of this body called Mary or...
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
So are there different levels of awakening? Because there's awakening, sometimes you hear about Satori experiences and then full enlightenment. Are there different levels?
I wouldn't necessarily say there's different levels, but I think your question is getting to something important. Number one, a lot of what's called awakening really isn't. A lot of what is called awakening actually has a lot more to do with mystical experiences than with awakening. That's a whole other subject. But to really get to what you're saying is, it's not so much that there's levels, but it appears as though it's very possible, and not only possible, that it's almost the norm for people to kind of break free of this illusory self, to have an awakening from it or beyond it or within it, however you want to think about it, but then have some, how could we call it, some tendency or some karmic pull that then they get pulled back into identification, right? So people,
right.
Have this sense of, I thought that I was who I thought I was yesterday.
Right.
And then today, I'm back being the person that I saw that I wasn't. Like that? Right. So I think probably with a lot of the listeners, a lot of people can identify with moments like that. And that's not so much like a lower level of awakening. That's like, the image I like to use is, there's those trick birthday candles that you blow out,
uh-huh.
and then you think they're blown out,
uh-huh.
but then they just 5 seconds later they relight themselves. That's kind of what happens for a lot of people, is they can kind of see beyond the veil of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you see beyond the veil, one of the feelings of it is that you can never be deluded again.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what it feels like. It feels like you can never lose sight of this. Yeah, because it's so obvious.
Right.
But it seems like most people are hooked up so that it's a bit more like a trick birthday candle. You kind of see beyond the veil only to have the illusion of you kind of spontaneously relight itself.
I am so glad to hear you explaining it this way, because when I had what feels like it could have been the awakening type experience about 4 years ago, and after a lot of intense personal growth work and then getting into mm-hmm. Byron Katie's work, so I was really in the who would I be without that thought, and really hanging in that for about 3 or 4 days, like just intensely, and then it just popped into this state, which seemed to go on for about 3 weeks. And then I've often said to myself, it's sort of like I can just sit there and watch. It's like, oh, here you are. You're going under.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even to witness yourself being like, okay, I'm totally being in reaction, and this is so, like, just a story that I'm telling myself, but it's like, boy, I'm really falling for it.
That's the kind of strange thing about, like, your experience is a really great example of what so many people experience, and I'm sure you're aware of that, or I hope you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because it happens that way, and the strange thing is that when someone's had that kind of an experience, it's like you know that certain patterns that re-arise aren't true. But it's strange then, because you can have patterns of thought and feeling and reaction arise that you know have no reality and aren't true, but they'll still arise and play themselves out anyway, which is kind of odd. Like before, they arose and they played themselves out and you thought they were true.
Right.
And you would think when you see through them that they would just kind of stop. But some do, and for most people, some don't. Some will reemerge for a certain period of time.
So I imagine there are quite a few people, maybe like myself, that have had some type of experience. They've either done a lot of thought songs, they've done a lot of study and so forth, and they're still finding themselves in that kind of in-between place where they have a sense of, okay, I think I've been there, I think.
Yeah.
But what can somebody do to really allow that state of enlightenment or awakening to be more constant?
Yeah, that's the question. That's $100 million question.
You have the answer to that. I know you do.
Well, I have the answer, but the answer isn't necessarily a pleasant one. And what I mean by that is, up to a certain point in one's spiritual life, there are a lot of what I kind of think of as tricks of the trade. You know, like inquiry is a trick of the trade. Who would I be without my thoughts, right?
Right. I love that question.
When I say a trick, I don't mean in any sense derogatory. I mean, they're actually very useful. But, you know, the Buddhists call them skillful means. You know, I call them tricks of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And they may work. There's lots of them out there and lots of sort of direct pointings to the truth, things that can kind of open you to it. But most people, most everyone will find themselves at a particular point. If I can describe this clearly to help people understand it. See, these skillful means or tricks of the trade, they in essence get consciousness to bypass identity. They just bypass it and go to the greater reality. And it's really useful because then you really experience what it is. But what often happens is what you bypass to get there will drag you back. And that's why you experience, you know, this old identity will reemerge. And so eventually what everybody runs into is that eventually none of the tricks of the trade work anymore. They'll work for a period of time, and I say as long as they work, use them. As long as they help you to get beyond the veil of illusion, use them. But the time will come when they won't work, and everybody will be faced with their identity. That here's I'm going to say something that sounds totally contradictory, but it's the only way I know how to say it. Even though the sense of separate self or ego is an illusion, still, it must completely surrender. So when I say that, people inevitably ask me or they write me letters and say, if it doesn't exist anyway, then why does it have to surrender and who's there to surrender? And all I can say to people that, you know, would ask an intelligent question like that is basically, I can't tell you why. I can't explain it to you because you can only understand it once it's happened. Which isn't a great explanation, but it's the best I can come up with. Even though it's an illusion, that illusion needs to surrender itself, which is different than a technique allowing you to bypass the illusion to get to a greater reality. Does that make sense?
I'm kind of getting it.
I know, I'm going kind of fast, all right?
Actually, I think it's great because I think we actually have a lot of advanced listeners on here.
Yeah.
So,
and people can re-listen to it, which is nice about having
it's really nice about the recording. Even me, I can re-listen to it.
A quick sum up is that through the techniques like the one you were talking about with Byron Katie, it allowed your consciousness to bypass your identity And when it bypasses, it gets to the reality and it sees that your identity, who you thought you were, isn't who you were. And so there's freedom. But as long as that but even with that experience, identity itself can still remain intact.
Okay.
And if it does, it's going to pull consciousness back into its domain.
It really keeps coming back to surrendering identity, surrendering
exactly.
the illusions that pop up.
So, yes.
So, I don't know.
The identity itself that is at some point, in some way, somehow, is going to have to surrender itself.
So I don't know if you could you give an example of, you know, let's say somebody is, you know, they know this, they've been in it, and they're at the point and they're totally, let's say, stuck in a fear, something fear kind of shows up for them.
Yeah, very common, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so, in our little human experience.
Yeah.
Is there, like, how would you describe somebody who, I don't know, if you say adequately surrenders to the fear? Like, what does that look like?
I'll talk about my own experience so that it's not abstract.
Okay.
Because I'm always really honest telling people that, you know, overt fear was never a real big part of my spiritual process. It is for a lot of people. It probably is for most people in a certain way, but it wasn't really an overt big part of my process. But there was a sort of a moment when all the fear was crystallized into a moment where it was very certain to me that what was happening within me, because there was a very powerful experience that was happening, that what was happening within me was going to kill me physically, was going to kill the body. It was too much for the body to handle. And, of course, immediately the fear of not existing anymore came up. And what arose as soon as it was clear to me that I wouldn't survive this if it kept going, the response that came up was, if this is what it takes to see the truth, then okay. And as soon as there was the okay, which was, there was something that was willing to die, literally, I mean physically die, if for the truth. And as soon as that came into consciousness, then the experience that was seemed so threatening literally disappeared, like in the time that you could snap your fingers. It completely, completely, completely disappeared. And, you know, something else unfolded that I really won't go into now, but the thing about it is, see, that moment when there was a willingness to die wasn't something I manufactured. It wasn't like courageous, it wasn't like macho, it wasn't like, you know, standing up in the face of fear and being very, it was actually something that was extraordinarily simple, and even though the internal feeling in the body was very chaotic, it was a very simple thing that was like, it was almost surprising to me, like, oh, I actually would die if that's what it took. I mean, I would do it without a second thought, so it was sort of surprising to me. And I find that's the thing with this particular juncture point that you're speaking about here, is that I'm saying that what's really called for is the illusion of who we think we are to really surrender itself. And yet that surrender isn't really a product of courage. It's like either it is willing to surrender itself or it's not. If it's not, it just stays in fear.
I think that's a very useful explanation.
Yeah, like I say, you know, when I started to give it, I said, you know, it may not be what you or people listening want to hear, because it's not like here's the three steps to deal with your existential terror.
Right. Surrender. Just basically give it up.
Yeah, the bottom line, there isn't three steps. I mean, I think that's part of the illusion people deal with. They come to me a lot, and I'm sure you've heard them, and a lot of listeners have experienced this, and they're like, I'm feeling, you know, terrified. I feel I'm coming up to the edge of, it feels like I won't exist anymore, and I'm terrified, and what do I do? And they think that a spiritual teacher is going to have, like, the 10 easy steps how to dissipate the fear. And all I can really tell them is, well, maybe you could dissipate the fear, but in terms of awakening, that would not be advisable. again, it's not about feeling better, it's about whatever you need to go through to find out what's true. And in the end, it's a surrender game. That's what it is.
And
the ego doesn't even know how to surrender, right? The identity would say, but I don't even know how to do it. I don't even know the first step of surrendering. And I would go, of course, not knowing how is the first step in surrendering. It's admitting that you don't even know how to surrender. That's the first step, and that's a big step.
You're listening to Conversations with the Masters with host Mary Allen. Mary Allen is a pioneer and leader in the coaching industry and author of the life-altering book, The Power of Inner Choice, 12 Weeks to Living a Life You Love, available everywhere. For more information on this and other coaching services designed to enlighten and empower you, visit lifecoachmary.com. And now, back to our conversation with the Masters.
Do you think that setting up an intention to want to step into surrender and just willingness, it's like, you know, I don't know how, but I guess you're then surrendering to the how too, which takes you back to surrender in a way.
Intention is always great as long as intention is actually true. In other words, the intention can't be intellectual. If your intention actually is to surrender, then surrender will happen. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and I think
if you're creating an intention in order to help you surrender, that means your intention is not it's more intellectual. It's not actually connected with your emotion.
Which actually takes us to one of the other messages that I love is just about letting go of manipulation altogether.
Yeah. Well, that's basically, that's what we're talking about in a way. I mean, as you know from reading the book on meditation, that's what I see the whole foundation of meditation. And now maybe you and the people who are listening would understand why I see it the foundation of meditation, because sooner or later, you're going to come up against very deep and profound points where surrender is going to be absolutely what's going to be the only thing that there is to do. And surrender basically means allow everything to be as it is. That's surrender. And that's the whole heart of it. And so in meditation, I always say, since that's what everyone's going to have to deal with eventually, why not deal with it right from the beginning? Why not make it, if you're going to meditate, why don't you make it your meditation practice from the very beginning?
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk about that a minute. Just the purpose of meditation as it plays its role in awakening. I mean, how does that play a role in awakening, meditation?
I'd love to be able to give you a great answer to that. Like, you know, if you do this meditation for 10 years, you'll awaken.
Right.
That's not how it works, obviously, because we all know people who've been meditating for 30, 40, 50 years and haven't awakened. If we're meditating correctly, it can have a really useful role to play. Unfortunately, most people aren't meditating correctly in terms of awakening. Meditation can serve a lot of purposes and a lot of agendas, but when it has to do with real awakening, most people's the way they meditate is actually new and more subtle ways to control their experience.
Ah.
You think about the techniques, what's basically happening is you're controlling your mind. And the essence of awakening is completely letting go of control. So you start to see why so many people meditate with these techniques that are controlling. And all they learn how to do in the end is to control their minds better.
Which can be functionally useful, but not necessarily.
I'm glad you said that. You're right. It can be very functionally useful. Yeah. If people just want to be able to be more peaceful and more calm and deal with life situations without so much anxiety, I would say, that's fine. Go ahead and do that kind of meditation. It'll help you out. It'll help you to dream better. And there's nothing wrong with dreaming better.
But for the person that is really sincerely interested in awakening,
yeah,
like, what would you say are the maybe the correct ways to meditate that would actually support that path?
Well, the main thing is literally it's extraordinarily simple, which is why it's very demanding. Which is, you sit down and you let everything be. You absolutely let everything be. And if there is a practice or a technique to it, you're simply noticing any movement of mind or body or anything where you notice that you're not allowing everything to be as it is. And when you notice that some part of you isn't allowing, you just notice it. And you allow that to be. And when you start to allow that to be, it softens and it lets go. See, so that's in the most simple way, that's really the meditation technique, let everything be as it is. And people usually have to really investigate, like, what is it to allow everything to be? It's a very, very deep thing. And what happens, what's experienced in the body and the mind when we do allow everything to be? So in other words, it's important that the meditation to allow everything to be not be a goal. It's not like you're sitting down and your goal is to allow everything to be. Because then you've turned it into a pursuit of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, mind...
Once again.
Yeah, minds like goals they can chase. Instead, turn it into an investigation. It's more like what happens, which means what's happening right now when I allow everything to be. What happens now? If there's thinking, what happens when I allow the mind to think and don't even try to stop it? What happens? What happens if I have a feeling that I say I don't want to have? What happens to it when I truly, completely, totally allow it to be? See, so by introducing the what happens, the question, it becomes the process of like a living, breathing investigation rather than a goal.
With investigation, there's a little bit less attachment, more just, okay, let's just get curious and keep it.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see what happens when I allow this to be. And maybe someday you sit down and it seems like you can't let anything be, right? Everything's in contradiction and struggle and you're having a tough time. And you can say, well, what happens when I allow that to be? You see, so it can never be so bad to such a point that you think you're failing, because no matter what happens, even if you're struggling mightily, you can ask yourself, well, what's it like if I let struggle just be completely, totally?
We're back to surrender.
And of course, like I said, this kind of meditation can actually help introduce us to a natural state of peace, a state of peace that's not achieved through the controlling mind and body, but actually achieved through letting go of control of mind-body, because the underlying idea here is something that's inherent in enlightenment itself, which is you realize that when everything is allowed to be as it is, the nature of things has a tendency to move back into equilibrium. That's the nature of things. Everything moves into equilibrium. Everything actually naturally and spontaneously is always moving towards awakening. The only thing you and I got to do as people or parent people is to get out of the way of that. So that's the underlying realization, is everything actually is always leading back to harmony. And ultimately, everything is leading. Its very nature of everything is to lead right to the truth. That's the nature of existence.
I think that's the thing that maybe people find the hardest is even letting go then outside of meditation in their own lives. It's like, well, what would happen if I really let go completely?
Yeah, that's it. Right. Right.
So what is it to live life when you've really let go of control, and it's, you know, you're not trying to either artificially, I always like to say, either artificially trying to speed things up or artificially trying to slow things down.
That's a great way of putting it, yeah. What's it like? It's very simple. It's very simple because you're not in conflict with the movement of life. So I like the way you put it. Not artificially trying to speed it up, not artificially trying to slow it down. And I would add, not in any way artificially interpreting it. That's why it's taught, enlightenment is talked about as peace and ease and contentment. It's not just peace and ease and contentment and joy because we're sitting there like a stone doing nothing. It's not like that. It's the peace and the ease and the contentment and the joy comes because there's no longer this illusion of a me to separate itself from the flow of life. So the flow of life is our flow, and there's no resistance. So it's really just sort of life without resistance.
Life without resistance.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that if I really were to just, you know, let go of control, that they might end up sitting on the couch and watching television all day, or, you know, going hiking and never coming back, and then they'd have bills and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience of, I mean, is that really what happens for people, or can
my
productive human beings that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that question a lot too. And the only way your answer is, do you want to know the truth bad enough to find out? Because I can't give anybody guarantees.
Right.
I can't tell you it's all going to work out. You know, it's all going to work out well, or you won't delude yourself. Or, in the awakening business, like any other avenue of life, there are casualties, right? And we see them. There's spiritual casualties. There's people that get stuck in lots of different sort of spiritual cul-de-sacs. They might get stuck in indifference. They might get stuck in, like you said, sitting on their couch and never being motivated to do anything ever again. I mean, these aren't the truth, but these are potential pitfalls. And I think, one of the things is, I think a lot of people in spirituality, the teachers don't level with them. I don't know why teachers don't level with their students often. I think maybe it'll scare them. I have no idea. But the truth is that the realization game is not a side thing. It's not something to play with. It's about reality. It's reality and not reality. And I wouldn't even advise anybody to do it unless you have to do it. How's that for a spiritual teaching?
unless we feel so compelled to.
Yeah. Why bother?
Yeah, I guess it's a good question, huh?
You see, I don't say that like I don't mean it the way it may sound, like why bother, but what I'm saying is the authentic impulse towards reality is really, it's not really what can this do for me.
Yeah.
A lot of us start there, but if it's really the real impulse, I call the real impulse towards enlightenment an irrational impulse, because it's that impulse that ultimately, it's no longer concerned of, will this work for me, and will this help me get a better job, and will this guarantee I'll be a wonderful person or save humanity? It's an impulse that to the mind doesn't make sense.
Right.
It's the impulse, it's like truth or bust. You see what I mean? In retrospect, once we realize the nature of reality, yeah, then our lives tend to be simpler in the sense we're not resisting, we're much more in flow. The byproducts of awakening are very pleasant and very nice, and from that point of view, it's like, you know, who would have it any other way? But the impulse towards reality, everyone will ultimately come up against the parts of themselves where that within them which is the real impulse towards reality, and that within them which is ultimately the fears of the separate person, which is, will this work? Will I still be a good mother or a good father?
Yeah.
Will I still be a a good citizen and working well for the welfare of all beings and all that kind of stuff. You know, that ultimately, yeah, it might, it, yeah, it, and sometimes it does for a while. It might. I mean, because as if when your identity really comes crumbling, it's the whole way, it's the way you and I view the entire world and everybody in it. I mean, it, what we see is it's not true. And in seeing that, it literally crumbles. And in the crumbling, depending on how you're hooked up, you may resist the crumbling, or you may just let it happen. If you resist it, even the falling away of illusions can be very disconcerting. If you don't resist it, of course, the falling away of illusions is wonderful. But for most people, it's somewhere in between for a while. Somewhere between wonderful and very disorienting and disconcerting. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's a total reorientation. It's very romantic to say, you know, it's enlightenment to seeing things as they are. But to actually get to the point where we can see things the way they are, and not just for a minute, but actually live it in relationships and going to work and the rough and tumble of life, it's a you know, a disassembling of our illusions to is going to have to take place to a level that few people can even imagine.
But then it seems like, I mean, certainly to see what you're doing with your life, I mean, there's clearly a creative force that's running
yeah.
for you that is allowing you to contribute to the world, and this is your path, and lots of people will manifest that in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the other part. So now that I got done with the scary stuff.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, it's the honest stuff, you know, because I find most people that are in the middle of the process, they really know what I'm talking about. Of course, as I see it and as I've experienced it, this whole sort of journey, if we want to call it that, to really realization is really so that, I mean, it's the impulse of reality to become fully conscious of itself. But what happens as a result of that is within every being, everywhere, is an incredibly creative impulse. There is a way that everybody, if they could just wake up from their sense of isolation and separateness, there's a creative impulse, there's just the impulse of life that will live itself through them in a way that you can never predict, and is really quite beautiful. The whole awakening thing, in one way of seeing it, seems to be for nothing other than so that this extraordinarily creative impulse that lies at the soul of the seat of each being can manifest itself, can flower, and can it's like reality expressing itself in a very clear way, in a very clean way, in a very creative way. So this whole thing, the whole enlightenment movement towards enlightenment isn't as I see it, so we just get this experience, we have direct connection with reality, we realize that we are reality, that the separate person is an illusion. It's not just about collecting these insights or these knowings. There is something that is almost birthed through us as a human being as a result of it. And that's extraordinarily creative.
And do you think that, you know, there's some people that, I don't know if we would say that they've gone through a path of enlightenment, but people like Beethoven or people that have gone out and really done extraordinary work that didn't seem like they were resistant to this creative force within them. They just let it flow.
Yeah.
And is that the same thing as enlightenment, or they're just going with the flow and not even aware that they're necessarily still going with the flow?
It's sort of like we see this like in people that are, I think Beethoven's a great example in music, in the arts, great painters and poets and even
inventors.
Athletes. What's that?
Inventors.
Inventors. Yeah, there's people that can be completely in the flow, in total tune, in a narrow segment of their life. And when someone can do that, they have incredible creativity there and creative achievement there, right? spirituality really is about not simply having incredible creativity or achievement in one area of life, or to be, we could say, I won't even really say awake in that aspect, but it's to do a very similar thing in all areas, life itself. For those people, they can let go in that one narrow domain in their life, and the creativity that flows through them is extraordinary. Enlightenment is basically just saying, kind of like, look, that's the natural state of things, folks. That's not for special people. That's for everybody.
Right.
That same creative impulse is there, and spirituality is to say, don't even, why be satisfied with having it in one area of your life, right? Because most of these people, even that do this incredible creative work, a lot of them are absolute wrecks in the rest of their life.
Right, right.
Some of the most creative people are actually some of the most suffering people. Not always, but often.
Right.
Certainly
true of, I think, Einstein, lots of inventions, but really horrendous relationships.
So these are sort of point to the potential of a human being that's not in resistance in that segment of their life. Enlightenment is just getting seen totally through the illusion of the separate person, so there isn't resistance in the rest of life. And then there's that same creative flow. It may not be noticed. You may not be an Einstein or a Beethoven or something like that. Often it's not. It may not play a part that's noticed or by anybody. But, you know, when we're really awake, the nice thing is it doesn't matter.
Right.
Being noticed or having a big part to play isn't any more satisfying than having a totally anonymous part to play. It's all good. It just doesn't matter.
Well, I think I have another one of those big questions here that we have 8 minutes left. So what are the five truths about truth?
Oh, okay.
I'm so unfair. Here, I give you 6 minutes.
Well, that's okay. I've been speaking a lot to each of your questions. okay. Well, we'll just throw these out. We'll see what everybody can make of them.
Yeah.
And these are just kind of, I guess you'd just say observations, and they may spark the recognition in some people. So, the first truth about truth is truth is that which is everything. Truth is that which is everything. It's sort of a way of saying all is one, but I always like to interpret some of these old traditional sayings in a way that may make a little more practical sense and give people a little more practical connection. So the truth is that which is everything. If you find a truth that's not applicable to everything everywhere at all times, then it's not the truth. The second one is truth is self-luminous and aware and creative. Self-luminous means the nature of reality is that it is conscious. It is conscious of itself. The great reality is luminous. That's what luminous means. It doesn't mean that there's light streaming off it necessarily. It just means that it is self-aware. It's the nature of reality. And it's what waking up shows us, is that that's what awakening is, reality being conscious of itself. The third is, being the nature of everything, there is nothing outside of the truth. So, in this sense, we usually speak of truths, we speak of relative truths, but where there's, you know, this is true as opposed to something else. But the ultimate truth is the one, is that which is everything. Being the nature of everything, there's literally nothing outside of the truth. Being the one, there's nothing that's outside of the truth. Everything's an expression of the one, of the truth. Everything, everywhere, all the time, no matter what dimension you're in, everything is an expression or manifestation of the one. The fourth is, truth doesn't explain anything. Truth is everything. That's one of my favorites, because as a teacher I get, you know, naturally students or seekers, they want explanations for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way our minds are hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth doesn't actually explain anything. The truth is everything. When we realize that we are the truth which is everything, the funny thing, there's nothing left to explain. We only look for explanations when we are separate from something. When it's realized that we are not separate, then explanations are, they just don't make any sense from that perspective. There's no need for explanations because there is no separation. So that can, that one hooks a lot of people. They're looking all the time for explanations for things, thinking that's going to help them realize the truth, or reality or God, however they think about it. But actually it's the pursuit of looking for explanations that is part of that which hides truth. That makes sense. Hides ultimate reality. And the last one is the only thing that realizes the truth is the truth itself. That's what I talked about earlier when I said it's not me or you as apparent people who wake up. It's reality that wakes up. It's the one that wakes up. We wake up from who we think we are. Who we think we are never awakens. The one that's pursuing enlightenment never gets it. When awakening happens, we wake up from the one that was pursuing enlightenment. That's the funny thing about it.
Is it possible to awaken without having the intention to awaken?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it happens to people just, you know, I meet people occasionally when I travel, you know, they're just going along, living their lives, and all of a sudden, boom, something happens completely out of the blue. The thing about, you know, truth or reality is it doesn't play by the rules that we set.
Uh-huh.
Anything's possible.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it comes from an intention. We may even say often it arises seemingly after, you know, certain seeking and intention. But there's many examples that it also works in different ways. It happens to people who weren't seeking it and didn't even have any inkling of it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people that have come to me simply so they could talk to somebody who knew what they were talking about.
Right. It's one of the biggest challenges if you have an awakening type experience that nobody understands what you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of get a little more wise about who you talk about.
People don't get this.
No, because reality. I mean, you know, when we're in an illusion, how's reality going to look from the perspective of illusion? It's going to look kind of nutty, right?
Well, so what would be maybe the, since we have 1 minute, I feel like we could go on for hours here, but
we could.
But for people that are either just beginning a spiritual path or, you know, they're somewhere in the middle of it,
yeah.
What pointers, directions where would you point them?
That's a good question. I like to keep it, as I've said a few times, as simple as possible, because the deepest things are often contained in the most simple and overlooked places. So I think a great place to start, and this isn't just for someone who's starting, but anybody, anywhere in their spiritual life, is to start with the awareness that's already functioning. Right? Just start with noticing that there is this capacity, there is this constant state of awareness. Always there is awareness. Always there's consciousness. And notice that your mind says to itself in unconscious ways that this awareness is mine. I'm being aware. I'm the one that's conscious. And just without looking for answers, just look at that and see that it's actually, there's only awareness that's aware, that the me and the I is just something that thought keeps imposing. And just notice that the awareness that's already functioning, that's your doorway. That's your doorway, just putting attention on that awareness. If someone did nothing more than that, the practice of giving recognition, yes, this awareness is here. Yes, it is here. If you did nothing more than give a recognition to that, I would think you'd probably be doing a spiritual practice, if I could say, put it that way, that is, would be more effective and more useful than most others.
It's something that you don't necessarily have to do anything extra, just notice the awareness.
Right, I call it a practice of humility, because it doesn't take any humility to try to direct awareness and play with it and do something with it. It takes a lot of humility just to notice it's already here. And stillness and silence, and all those things are already here before you chase them and try to find them. And so the practice is a practice of recognition.
Great. Well, thank you so very much for your time today. We may need to do this again and continue on, perhaps.
You're welcome. I had a great time talking with you.
Really wonderful. Yeah. And I know our listeners are probably listening at every single word and taking it all in and are very appreciative. I'll open up lines in a minute. They can thank you personally. I do just want to announce that if those of you that would like more of Adi Ashanti, if you go to his website, adiashanti.org, and that will be in the follow-up notes, he's got so many resources available that just will really impact you if you are sincerely interested in going on this path. So any final thoughts to our listeners before
I'm glad you asked that, Marianne, because I did have one final very quick thought.
Yeah.
And it's something I like to often say to people after I've, you know, given a talk or anything, and that is that don't believe anything simply because I've said it. Everything is either to be proved true or false within each person, and that's the authority that each person has in themselves and for themselves, actually just believing in something because a spiritual authority said it. It will derail the enlightenment process very quickly. So I invite each person to have the freedom to look at anything that was said and to really inquire into it and find out the truth or the falseness of it for yourself, because that's the authority that each person has for themselves, and it's a very important one not to abdicate to somebody else.
Very well.
That's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Adia. I look forward to spending 5-6 days with you in May.
Thank you.
And be well, everyone, and I'll open up the lines, and you all can thank Adia yourself.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Conversations with the Masters with your host, Mary Allen. If you would like to participate in upcoming live conference call interviews, visit www.lifecoachmary.com. Transcripts and audio of previous interviews with such masters as Wayne Dyer, Carolyn Mace, Debbie Ford, Byron Katie, and others are available on iTunes or at www.lifecoachmary.com. For more information on the work of Mary Allen, her upcoming Success and Inner Peace Boot Camp, or to sign up for her free online newsletter, Soulfully Living, and to receive inspiring daily quotes, visit lifecoachmary.com. Thank you for being committed to your own personal and spiritual development, and thank you for spreading the word about the Conversations with the Masters series. We wish you a fabulous day.